We're in Daniel chapter 2. I'm going to review fairly rapidly the first part of the chapter, and then seek to cover the last part of the chapter this evening. I've entitled this message, God Who Reveals Secrets. This is part 2 of the message. And once again, I want to review fairly rapidly. Really, we're going to get into the last section, the interpretation of the dream primarily this evening. But let me review a little bit. First of all, I talked about the narrative structure. The actual chapter, it's a narrative section dealing with really several dreams that Nebuchadnezzar had, but one primarily that stuck out to him, that concerned him. There is what I'll call a chiastic pattern here. In other words, the structure of the chapter itself is laid out in a certain particular way. And I look at the idea of A, B, C, B, A. It starts out with something, goes to something else, and then sort of reverses that pattern. And if you'll see there, it starts out with Nebuchadnezzar, kind of the focus of the chapter. Then it shifts to Daniel being the focus. Then God's the focus. Back to Daniel, then ending up with Nebuchadnezzar and what he's saying. And there's not only a pattern here, but there is a purpose. These structures, whenever something is structured like that, you will see that perhaps in the Psalms, particularly in Proverbs, but some of the wisdom literature, there's structure. It's there for a purpose. I gave you three purposes, if you would. First of all, I think it demonstrates order and control. These events that are being prescribed in this passage are not accidental. They are laid out by the Lord, where He's giving us a sense of being orderly and the fact that He's in control of what's taking place in life. Secondly, there is a sense of completion. I liken this to like what we would often call full circle writing in literature. If you've read a story, seen a movie or whatever, where it kind of starts out at a certain spot, sort of almost the end of the story, if you would, and then it kind of starts there, reviews back over what happened, how it all began, comes back and ends up where it started. And what that does is it gives you a sense of completion, that there is a cycle that's being completed here, that God is communicating something to us and a sense of completion that He's communicating. And thirdly, it sort of highlights the central message, the idea that the ABC, C being the predominant thing, the predominant part of what this passage is talking about. This is a passage that's not about Nebuchadnezzar. It's not even about Daniel. It's about God. In fact, that's the whole book is about the Lord. But the chapter lays out that theme, and one of the ways it does it is through this pattern, this structure that's there. So, first of all, the narrative structure. Secondly, the narrative purpose. We talked about most of this last week as well. I see three purposes that what the Lord is doing. First of all, He's demonstrating His ability to protect and also to position Daniel and his companions. If you look in chapter 2 and verse 18, says they're praying to the Lord that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. Why? That, or in order that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. They were all going to die. And so one of the things that God is doing here is He's stepping on the scene, demonstrating His ability, His power to be able to protect Daniel. Not only does He protect him, but He positions him. We'll say more about that this evening. But if you look over in chapter 2, verse 48, it says, then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. So God uniquely takes Daniel and places him into a position of prominence. This is not something that you would have expected. It's not something that Daniel probably would have ever even imagined, but it's what God is doing. And that's part of the purpose of this passage. Secondly, the other thing the Lord is doing in this passage is He is revealing about what's going to happen in the latter days. Chapter 2 and verse 28 talks about the fact that it says, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to King Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Nebuchadnezzar has been thinking about his kingdom. He is looking out as he observes all his kingdom. He's thinking about what's going to happen to my kingdom once I pass off the scene. What's coming in the future? And God uses those thoughts to give to Nebuchadnezzar a dream, which is going to reveal not only what's going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, but what's going to happen to future kingdoms on into the very end times. And so one of the purposes of this passage is to reveal what's going to happen in the latter days. Thirdly, God is also demonstrating His wisdom and power. If you turn over to chapter 2 and verse 47, this is Nebuchadnezzar here who says, the king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal the secret. Nobody else could do this. And so God steps on the scene, reveals to Daniel not only the dream, but also the interpretation. And from that, Nebuchadnezzar steps back and said, wow, what a God. And so one of the things the Lord is doing is he's demonstrating his wisdom and his power as this narrative unfolds. Thirdly, we talked about the narrative's content. We covered part of this. I'm just going to review kind of briefly to give us an overview to get us into where we're going tonight. We talked about him dreaming dreams, first of all, verses 1 to 15. I mentioned to you that in this section, it's not that Nebuchadnezzar has forgotten his dream. In fact, really what he's doing is he is withholding the dream or the information about the dream so that he can make sure that whatever they're going to tell him is true. And I know that for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is in verse 9, it says, but if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. That little phrase, when the thing is gone from me, is the matter, speaking of the decree that he's given, is gone from me. The idea is that this decree is sure, it's standing, and if you guys don't tell me what I want to hear, you're all going to die. And that becomes true because he gets angry. They say, look, king, no king would ever ask of his wise men what you've asked us. Nobody can tell you what you want to know except to be the gods, and they don't dwell with us. Nebuchadnezzar didn't receive that message very well. In fact, he got so angry, he decided he was going to kill them all. And what happens is they're gathering all the wise men together, including Daniel and his friends who are in this training time, if you would. And he's going to kill all of them in a mass execution. And so when Daniel finds out about it, he says, why is the hurry? What's the rush? And Arioch tells him what's going on, and he says, look, give me some time. If you give me some time, I'll go before the Lord, and he'll be able to tell the king what the dream is and what the interpretation is. So he seeks God as he's seeking the answer to this. Thankfully, God in his mercy and grace, and Daniel praises the Lord here. We looked briefly at that last week. Almost like a psalm, really. In fact, there are a lot of allusion to this section where what Daniel's doing is he's praising the Lord. He's alluding to the greatness of God, the wisdom of God, the power of God, that God has been able to tell him the dream, and he also has been able to tell him the interpretation. And so he's rejoicing in that, and then he's brought before the king, and he not only begins to tell the dream, in fact, look, if you would, in chapter 2, in verse 31, here's what he says, thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. So he's telling the king now what he saw. And you can almost envision Nebuchadnezzar as he's listening to this. His mouth is sort of dropping open, and he's just astonished that Daniel's able to tell him these things. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, the idea is it was shining and it was impressive. It stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible or awesome. This image's head was of fine gold. So there are parts. Starting with the head being gold, the breast and arms are silver, and his belly and his thighs are brass, and his legs are of iron, and his feet part of iron and part of clay. And then it says, thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that was of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. It goes on to say, this was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, the gold, broken into pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. In other words, it was just kind of blown away. And the wind carried him away, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. So by this time, Daniel has King Nebuchadnezzar's attention. Because nobody else has been able to tell him what the dream was, and certainly nobody else has been able to tell him what the interpretation of it. But you can sense here Nebuchadnezzar is all ears. He's wanting to hear what Daniel has to say. And then now tonight, I want to look at the fact that Daniel interprets the dreams. There are really five different parts to this. Four earthly kingdoms and then an eternal kingdom that he's going to talk about. Let's begin with the head, which is in verse 36 to 38, is the head of gold, which speaks of Babylon. If you'll notice, there are different metals. And most writers comment about the fact that the metals sort of decrease in value. And the kingdoms somewhat decrease in sense of prominence. But one of them, the first one, is clearly laid out as far as what this head is and what it represents. The other three, we have to kind of dig a little bit and pull together some things to be able to interpret the full passage. Beginning in verse 37, he says, "Thou art king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thy hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold." In other words, he's clearly telling him the fact that he's the head of gold. This is Nebuchadnezzar that he's talking to. Now, several things here. First of all, Wahlberg says this, which I think is interesting. He says, Nebuchadnezzar is addressed as the King of Kings, which position of power Daniel assigns as something that was a gift that was given by God, the God of heaven, to Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore his kingdom is one of power and strength and glory. The idea here is this is something, Nebuchadnezzar was a great man. He was able to accomplish a number of things, but Daniel is underscoring the fact it wasn't just Nebuchadnezzar. It was God giving him this kingdom. And the reason he became so powerful and so influential and so impressive, his kingdom was so impressive, was because God gave that to him. And so he's laying that out before Nebuchadnezzar as he's hearing these words. Robert goes on to point out this, that Nebuchadnezzar owes all his power to the God of heaven who has revealed this secret to Daniel. And so you can imagine as Nebuchadnezzar, who was pretty impressed with himself, we know that from Daniel chapter 4 when we get there, he was pretty impressed with his abilities and his building ability and his vision and all the other kind of things about his kingdom. He is clearly being told that God is the one who has given him the power and the position that has been given to him. Wood says this, the beasts and birds are mentioned as falling under his control as a way of emphasizing the degree of authority. In other words, in his kingdom and in that world at that time, he was the man. Everybody knew about Nebuchadnezzar. He was the one that was in charge of the world as we would think of it in that day. And nobody would even dare to question, to say anything about him. In fact, we find out a little bit later in the book, you just have to cross him and you can easily die because he'll just annihilate you. And so here's a guy who's being told very clearly that he's the head. He's the head of gold. Now it goes on to talk about the second kingdom, and that's found really in just the first part of verse 39. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. That's all it says. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. So it doesn't identify the kingdom in this particular passage, but we know from other passages that this is speaking of the Medo-Persian Empire that will follow the Babylonian Empire. Well, how do you know that? Well, let's look over on Daniel chapter 5 and verse 28 to begin with. Daniel chapter 5 and verse 28. This is the famous story of Belshazzar and how he had taken the vessels of the Lord out and he was having a party and praising the gods of silver and gold and the handwriting on the wall and Daniel interpreting what the handwriting meant. And in this section, he talks about, verse 28 says this, Perez, which is the idea of splitting, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. To begin with, this was a Medo-Persian empire. Later, the Persians sort of dominated, but it began as a combined empire of the Medo-Persian empire. The very next kingdom to come on the scenes, and really in this section, in fact, look at verse 29. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he would be the third ruler in the kingdom. In that night, the very night that Daniel interprets this for him, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And the Babylonian Empire, as it had been known, really came to a close, and the Medo-Persian Empire was established there. So, Daniel chapter 5 and verse 28. Then Daniel chapter 8, if you want to turn there, in verse 20. One of the things about the structure of the book of Daniel you'll find, as you get into the latter part of the book, Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7 are sort of parallel chapters, and then later, particularly in chapter 8, And in chapters 10 to 12, there's almost kind of a breakdown of some of these sections where they sort of take a microscope and sort of zero in on certain things, events that are happening upon the earth. And that's kind of what's happening in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 20. Here he's talking about a ram that's going to come. The nation there is pictured as a ram, the kingdom there. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. So this is paralleling what's happening in chapter 2 and chapter 7, and he's talking about the next kingdom that's going to come on the scene is going to be the Medo-Persian Empire. Then one last verse, chapter 11 of Daniel, and verse 2. Chapter 11, verse 1, "And I also, the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth king shall be richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." We'll come back to that in a moment. But here he's talking about the Medes and the Persians. So three different passages that are sort of underscoring this next kingdom that's going to happen in Daniel chapter 2, where it talks about the breast and the arms of silver is speaking of the Medo-Persian Empire. Warburg says this, "The statement that the second kingdom is inferior means inferior in quality, but not necessarily in every respect. History confirms that the Medo-Persian Empire lacked the central authority and fine organization which characterized the Babylonian Empire." So when it talks about it being inferior, he's talking about the fact that it's inferior, but not in every way. And he's mentioning here that this particular kingdom had, it was weaker than the Babylonian Empire. He had a very centralized authority and organization in the Babylonian Empire. When the Medo-Persians came on, it wasn't that centralized. So he mentions that here in this section. Then thirdly, the belly and thighs of brass. Back to chapter 2 again, and the last part of verse 39. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 39 says this, "After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee." And then it goes on to say, "And another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth." Once again, that's all it says about it. So we have to kind of say, okay, well, what exactly is he talking about? He's obviously talking about kingdoms, but who's that next kingdom? And most writers, I think rightly so, believe this to be the Grecian Empire, with Alexander the Great being sort of the major ruler or player, if you would. A couple parallel passages there. Daniel chapter 8, if you want to turn there again. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 21. Daniel chapter 8 verse 21 says this, "And the rough goat," so we talked before about the ram with the two horns, speaking of the Medo-Persian Empire, but then it says, verse 21, "And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king." Most writers see that as a picture of Alexander the Great, who's sort of the dominant king of that Grecian Empire. Later is going to be split. We'll talk about that later when we get to other sections, but here he's naming it as Grecia or Greece. Okay, then the chapter I did read, or the verse I did read, chapter 11 and verse 2 again, it talks about at the end of the verse that one of the Persian kings stirs up all against the realm of Greece. He was not able to conquer Greece. And later what happened is Alexander came back. And the section in Daniel pictures him as a leopard who was able to conquer quickly and very rapidly. And we know about Alexander that, it, you know, when he had conquered everything there was to conquer, he sat down and wept because there was no more world to conquer. And he's talking about the fact that there's coming a time from Daniel's perspective, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, there's going to be the Medo-Persian Empire, then there's going to be the Grecian Empire. And there's one more earthly empire he's going to talk about. That's the fourth kingdom that he speaks of here. And that's found in verses 40 to 43, which says, "And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and so doeth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break into pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken." Most writers see this as the Roman Empire. So these are like four major empires, the Babylonian Empire, followed by the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Grecian Empire, followed by the Roman Empire. And Rome was very powerful. It was amazing what they were able to accomplish, conquered a vast region of territory, unbelievable size of region of territory, which says this, "This fourth kingdom must be Rome, for it succeeded Greece." Now, as I looked at this, one of the problems in this passage is when the fifth kingdom comes on the scene, in fact, just look a little bit later in verse 44, it says, "And in the days of these kings." You got to decide what kings he's talking about there. Because historically, you had the Babylonians, then you had the Medo-Persians, then you had the Grecian Empire, then you had the Roman Empire, then the Roman Empire ended. Then there's kind of a jump, if you would, Because now he's going to talk about a fifth kingdom that's going to come against sort of a compilation of all of these kingdoms. And because of that, most writers see a time gap, if you would, between verses 42 and 43. And what they believe, as you move into this section toward the end of it, that this is a what we would call a revived form of the Roman Empire that's going to kind of reassemble in the last days, sort of all of humanity coming together and usurping itself against God. And it's at that time that the stone that's talked about in this passage of Scripture is going to come. And we do have a parallel for that. If you want to look in chapter 7, sort of the parallel chapter of Daniel 2, it speaks of these 10 kings and likened to the 10 toes talked about in the book of Daniel chapter 2. It says in verse 7 of chapter 7, "And this I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had a great iron teeth, and it devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns." Well, you say, well, so big deal, it had 10 horns. Well, if you look down in verse 24, you find out what the 10 horns are. It says, "And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings." It goes on to talk about speaking great words against the Most High. This is really talking about the Antichrist in the last days, and this revived Roman Empire that's going to come together, and the Antichrist is going to step up and become the ruler. And so when we look in Daniel chapter 2, what's happening is, in the end times, God is going to establish His own kingdom. In fact, back up to chapter 2 and verse 44, which leads me to the fifth thing, the stone cut without hands is basically God's eternal kingdom. Verse 44 says this, "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands," this phrase "without hands" speaks of the fact that it was not originated by man. This was something that was originated by God. There's no earthly or no humanly effort in all of this. This is a divine movement of God where this stone strikes that image at its feet and it obliterates the feet, and the whole image comes tumbling down and it becomes like chaff that is blown away by the wind, which is speaking of God's eternal kingdom as He enters in this end of times as we think of it. If you look here, it goes on to talk about the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break into pieces the brass, the clay, the silver, the gold. The great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain and the interpretation sure. So he's saying you can count on this happening, Nebuchadnezzar. Now the sense here is that it's upon those 10 kings in that revived Roman Empire that the stone is going to strike, and then from that God is going to establish His eternal kingdom. I like what Archer says here. He says, "Not only Daniel 7, but parallel passages leave us no doubt that this fifth kingdom is the kingdom of God, ruled over by Christ, enduring eternally even after its earthly millennial phase is over." What's going to happen is God's going to step on the scene. He's going to set up His own kingdom where Jesus is going to rule from Jerusalem. He's going to establish what we call the millennial reign of Christ. That's going to be a literal reign of 1,000 years, we find out from the book of Revelation. But even after that, this kingdom that Jesus establishes is going to continue on eternally, and that's what this passage is talking about. Now, think about what's happening here for just a moment. A lot of information, very short time, kind of cryptic in its nature. Kind of have to pull from here and there to kind of put all this together to make it somewhat make sense. But Nebuchadnezzar likely never even imagined that this dream that he had that was concerning about his own kingdom and what would happen in the future would literally lead to Daniel from God revealing the future layout of all the ancient kingdoms and the dominant kingdoms, and then ultimately an eternal kingdom that God Himself would set up. And so as Nebuchadnezzar is hearing all of this, you can only imagine he's kind of taken back. Because he never dreamed, never imagined that all this was going to come from some little troubling dream that he had. God lays this thing out. I take comfort in this because, in essence, God is telling us what the future is going to be. He was telling Nebuchadnezzar, he was telling Daniel what the future is going to be, and then even for us, beyond those days, until the very end times, and you can look in the book of Revelation, which kind of parallels a lot of the book of Daniel and other chapters that we'll look at. Daniel chapter 9, very precise prophecies there. So the idea behind all of this is, hey, look, God knows exactly what he's doing. God knows exactly where he's going. He knows exactly what's going to happen in the future. Nothing is going to take him by surprise. After all, he's the one who sets up. He's the one who puts down. And in the end, he's going to step on the scene and his son is going to rule the entire earth, the entire world, in an eternal kingdom that will be a righteous kingdom that will last on and on and on. And so he's giving through Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar all of this is being unfolded. When you get to chapter 7, he likens these kingdoms to beasts. And they parallel what we're talking about here. But the whole idea is that God knows exactly what he's doing and where he's going. Now, the end of this chapter goes back to Nebuchadnezzar, chapter 2 and verse 46, where Nebuchadnezzar then promotes Daniel and his companions. He says, "Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshiped Daniel and commanded they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him." Think about what's happening here. This is Nebuchadnezzar. Archer says this. He says, "What a remarkable scene. The despot who but an hour before had ordered the execution of all of his wise men, prostrating himself before this foreign captive from a third-rate subject nation." I mean, this is Nebuchadnezzar who, falling on his face before Daniel, impressed by him knowing the dream and knowing what the dream means, and it just takes him back. He goes on to say this, "The king appointed Daniel civil governor of the entire capital province of Babylon." I think what he means, if you look in verse 48, "Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon." He says this was a post of highest importance in the political structure. Normally this position would be reserved for a Chaldean nobleman, a member like Nebuchadnezzar of what they considered the master race. Only a Babylonian could have this position. And yet, because of the Lord's blessing upon Daniel and the impression that it made upon Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel's being positioned in that high position. Wood says this about this. "The Babylonian Empire was divided into provinces, each with a head called a satrap. Daniel apparently was made satrap over the province of what we would call Babylon proper." In other words, sort of the central hub of the entire Babylonian Empire right underneath Nebuchadnezzar's nose. Now notice this, a position of high responsibility for one not yet having reached his 20th birthday. Okay, his 20th year. Remember, he was just a teen. He refused the king's meat. He refused the king's drink. He honored the Lord and God honored Daniel, and God has positioned Daniel in this very unique situation. And literally, he's going to be through all the Babylonian Empire. He's going to go into the Medo-Persian Empire, even into the reign of Cyrus. And before this book is over, he's going to be an old man who has had unusual opportunities and unusual challenges to see God do some great things. Now, ultimately, this chapter is about verse 47. Which says this, "The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth, it is that your God is a God of gods." In other words, there were no other gods that could do what Daniel had been able to do. "And a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret." So as a result of God giving to Daniel the insight and understanding about the dream and about the interpretation, what's happening is Nebuchadnezzar is forced, if you would, to confess there's no God like your God, Daniel. And here's this mighty despot of a ruler who is on his face before God's servant Daniel, just a young man. And God exalts himself there in Babylon and certainly makes an impression upon the king Nebuchadnezzar that had an impact upon him. I was thinking a little bit about this. Because it's wonderful to read the stories of Old Testament and New Testament because it teaches us about the Lord and who he is and what he's like. Sometimes I think we forget that. Sometimes I think we sort of grabble along here in this world and we struggle and we just kind of get discouraged and we kind of wonder if God even knows what's going on or if God can do anything about what's going on, and we find ourselves being discouraged and disheartened sometimes. And when you read a story like this, you're reminded of how great God is. Tonight you may have some problems you're facing. Some family issues, some health issues, financial issues, something that you've laying awake at night, tossed back and forth, and really had no answers, really didn't know what to do, really weren't even sure exactly how to pray. When you pray to the God of heaven, when you pray to Daniel's God, who is the God of the Bible, there's no dilemma, there's no situation that you would ever face, even a dream of an ancient king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar that nobody knew what it was, and he wasn't willing to tell, and yet here God reveals to Daniel the dream, all the details of the dream and the interpretation of it. So much so as Nebuchadnezzar hears that, he cannot but confess how the great God of Daniel is able to give him what nobody else could tell him. Even the wise men earlier had said, "Look, King, nobody can do what you're asking except the gods, and their dwelling is not with us." Remember Daniel as he came before Nebuchadnezzar, and they had said, they kind of ushered him in and said, "You know, here's a guy who can tell you what you want to know, King Nebuchadnezzar." And he says, "Oh, Belteshazzar, can you really tell me?" Daniel has a little fun. He says, "You know, can't the Chaldeans and the wise men and the magicians and the astrologer, aren't they able to tell you, Nebuchadnezzar?" And then he has that phrase, "But there is a God in heaven. There is a God in heaven." And I say to you tonight, my friend, there is a God in heaven. Whatever you're facing, whatever you're dealing with, no matter how difficult, no matter how unusual it might be, there is a God in heaven that can answer every need that you'll ever have. He's able to take a captive teenager, if you would, who's being trained there in the Babylonian household, who refuses to take the king's meat and king's drink. He's able to take him from kind of a newbie just being brought in to all of a sudden now he's over all the wise men. He's over all the affairs. They're the key chief province in Babylon. Only God can do that. As I was thinking about several passages in the Old Testament, one that sort of stood out. You remember when the children of Israel had been captive in Egypt and the Egyptians had made it miserable for them. I mean, they were bricklayers and workers, and they would take the straw away and tell them they still got to keep their quota, and they were being persecuted and really abused, as we would think of it in modern day standards. And they began to cry out unto the Lord. And I mean, they were captive people, and the Egyptians really didn't want to let them go. God sent a series of plagues that were there, and Pharaoh was hard-hearted, didn't listen to what God was saying. And then finally he sent the plague of the firstborn, and the people almost rose up in rebellion and said, "Get these Israelites out of here." And they went away. They thought everything was safe and secure. And it wasn't long as they were heading that way that the Egyptians changed their mind and decided that they would come after the Israelites. And there with the Red Sea before them and the Egyptian armies behind them, really they had nowhere to go and nothing they could do. They were really without any ability to defend themselves at all. And they cried out to the Lord once again. And God, in a miraculous way, parted the Red Sea. And those 1 to 2 million Israelites were able to walk across on dry ground. And when they got over on the other side and the Egyptians sought to follow them, what did God do? He allowed the walls of the Red Sea to come back upon them, and all the Israelites, the Pharaoh and the chariots and all the things that were there, they were destroyed. Only God could do that. And in Exodus chapter 15, there's a psalm, if you would, much like what's found in this chapter, where they're crying out and saying this: "Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like unto thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? No God like our God." Fear tonight, dear friend, that maybe we've forgotten that. No God like our God. He's the God of gods and the King of kings. As mighty as Nebuchadnezzar and all the other ancient rulers, Alexander the Great and others were, they didn't even begin to touch the greatness of our God. And it's celebrations like chapter 2 and Exodus chapter 15 where we just kind of stand back a little bit, our mouths fall open, and we say, "Lord, who is like unto you? There's no God like unto you." But tonight, dear friend, that's the God that we serve. So I want to encourage you tonight to lift your head if you're discouraged. To allow the Lord to speak to your heart, to encourage your soul, to recognize that, hey, if God can do this for Daniel and his companions in an ancient pagan society with an ancient, somewhat irritable despot, God is able to enter in the scenes and not only tell Nebuchadnezzar what he wants to hear, but he is able to position Daniel in a position of influence where he has a tremendous impact in this nation. That he can do anything for us. Most likely none of us will ever even find ourselves in the near the situation that's here. And if he can help Daniel, my friend, he can help you. This is the God that reveals secrets. There are no secrets with the Lord. He's the God of gods and the King of kings. He's the one that you know and the one that you serve and the one tonight that you can rest upon completely at peace and at rest, that there's no situation you'll ever face. There's nothing you'll ever deal with that God cannot enter on the scene and change and do what needs to be done, not for you and your glory, but for Him and His glory. And I believe what today God is looking for are some more Daniels. Perhaps from among some of the young people here tonight, or perhaps from some of the adults here, who are just, we'll call it naive enough to believe that God is the God of gods and the King of kings. That we can cry out to Him and look to Him and rest in Him and that He can do the supernatural in our day just like He did in Daniel's day. Because after all, He's the God of gods and King of kings, who is like unto Thee, O Lord, among the gods, who is like unto Thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders. That's the God that we serve. That's the God that's talked about in the book of Daniel chapter 2. Let's pray together. Father, sometimes we forget. We get so caught up in what we're dealing with and what we're facing and what we're struggling with and our emotions and our discouragements, our defeats, that we forget about You. We forget about how great You are. And I pray tonight that You would lift the hearts of folks here, some that just need to trust You. And to depend upon You and to look to You. Lord, that Your arm is not weary. Lord, Your strength is strong. And Lord, You can meet every need that we have. And I pray tonight that You would give us faith to trust implicitly in You, looking to You as the great God of heaven, as the God of gods and King of kings. May we understand tonight afresh and anew from Your Word how great You really are. May we become dependent upon You. May this passage of Scripture be an encouragement to our hearts this night, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.